we begin our discussion of the Chumash Bereishis, Tavshin Ayin Zayin, with the Parsha of Noach, as often is the case. The schedule doesn't permit us a shiur for Parshas Bereishis itself. And we begin the shiur this evening with a discussion concerning Noach himself. Certainly a great deal to talk about there. The state of the world, as described in the beginning of the parsha, is in absolute chaos, upheaval, and there's only one person, and then by extension his family, who's considered to be worthy of being saved, and that's Noach. The way the pasuk describes Noach in the first pasuk, Noach is ish tzaddik tamim haya bedorosav. He's a tzaddik, he's a tamim, complete tzaddik, bedorosav, in his generation. And as we know, Rashi quotes it for us, there are different reactions to the word bedorosav, exactly what the pasuk means to emphasize or perhaps to imply. What about if it wasn't bedorosav? Would things have been better? Would things have been worse? Yesh darshim l'shvach, v'yesh darshim l'gnai. Some say bedorosav. Even in such a generation, he managed to remain a tzaddik, all the more so in a better generation. That's the point of the pasuk. Others say perhaps slightly differently, or even the contrary. In his generation, he was considered a tzaddik, but in another generation, and the one that is always highlighted and mentioned by name is the generation of Avram, perhaps would not have been considered such a tzaddik. That's an interesting machlokas there. But be that as it may, Noach is saved, and with him in the Teva are all of the species of animals, beasts and birds, etc. And as we know, there are two of each. And that's mentioned in the Pasuk Yudtes, Perek Vav, Pasuk Yudtes. U'mikol achai, from all living creatures, mikol basar, from all flesh, shnayim, mikol, tavia la teva la chayositach, two of each you shall bring to the Teva. However, that number is not true for all species. For as we know, even there, interestingly, the Torah has not yet been given, but there is already a distinction drawn between Temeim and Tehorim, not what we would call non-kosher species and kosher species. For in the beginning of Perek Zion, we find Perek Zion Pasuk Beis, Mikol ha-behema ha-tahora, from all of the pure or kosher animals, tikat lecha shiva shiva, ish ve'ishto, seven of each. V'min ha-behema asher lo tahora hi, shnayim ish ve'ishto. So it's specifically of the impure animals that we say that there's two of them, because the behema tahora actually has seven of each. Which means, therefore, coming back to Pasuk Yotes, which seems to imply that all of the species, and the Pasuk really does say Mikol Hachai, Mikol Basar, and does not distinguish between Behema Tahura and Behema Temeya, and says about all of them that there are two. So Rashi explains that there, all of them will have no less than two. In other words, for the Temeim, it will be two and only two. For the Tahorim, it will be more than two. But that's also, in other words, the common denominator of all of them is two. On the words Shnayim Mikol, Rashi comments, Min ha-pachos shebahem, even the lower number, i.e. the Temeim, lo pachas u'mishnayim, no less than two, echad zachar, ve'echad nekeva. And should we ask, and perhaps we know already, why is it that of the Behema Tahora does Noach bring seven? I mean, what's their yichus here? Rashi tells us it was for the purpose of bringing korbonos, which we know happened. As soon as they came out of the teva, Noach took some. You can't take any species if there's only two of each. Rather, there were shiva shiva for purposes of korbonos. That's what Rashi says, and the Ibn Ezra, and Rabbeinu Bachya, and many other Mefarshim. Interestingly, there is an opinion among the Mefarshim that he took more of those because one of the transitions of the mabel is that afterwards it would be mutter to eat meat, and therefore he took more of those in order to allow them to for human consumption. But that's actually a little bit more difficult because, once again, Noah isn't Jewish, and when it becomes mutter to eat meat, there's no stipulation that he can only eat kosher food. And therefore, for purposes of eating, there's no distinction for Noah or his family or for a long, long time between kosher and non-kosher. It's only when it comes to korbanos that it would make a difference, and therefore the simpler understanding is the one quoted by Rashi, and as we mentioned, concurred with by these other Rishonim, that it was for purposes of korbanos that he brought these extra animals. However, there is a very simple parshanut question here to be raised, and that is the command to bring two of every animal, and then the command to bring seven of some animals. Those two commands are not written or stated, as far as we know, together. And by that we mean, and we've quoted the Pesukim, but it's worthwhile noting their location. The first time we see this is in Perek Vav, Pasuk Yud Tes, and that's where we have two of each. U'mikol achai, mikol basar, shnai mikol tavir lateva, so two of each. When it isn't for another few Pesukim that we will see the command to bring seven of the Tehoras. That's another three or four Pesukim's time. It's in a new Perek. That's not important for us. The Prokim is not a Jewish chalukah. But in Pasuk Beis, then we have Mikola Behemah Tehorah Tikach Lecha Shiva Shiva. But they're really the same topic. It's just different numbers. From the Temeya, two. From the Tehora, seven. So why aren't they put together? They could even be argued that they should be part of the same pasuk, but certainly one pasuk after the other. Rather, in between, we have seemingly other things. In pasuk kaf aleph of Perek Vav, we have the command to bring in food. V'atokach lecha mikol ha'machal asher yachel. You should bring, gather food for them. V'asatai lecha. That's Pasuk Kaf Aleph, the command to bring food. Pasuk Kaf Beis, Vayas Noach, Kuchol Asher Tziva Oso Elokim, Heinasa. And Noach did what he was told, which is, again, a difficult Pasuk, because that would seem like it's a Pasuk of summation, but we haven't finished yet. I mean, we're still kind of in the middle. But the Pasuk has this interim conclusion where Noach did as he was told. Then Pasuk Aleph of the next Pasuk, the next Perek, which is the Zion Aleph, Hashem tells him to come to the Teva. And only then do we have the Tzivoy, the command with regards to seven of each of the Tehora. So if we take a tally and enunciate the matters that are in between, they are, number one, the mitzvah to gather food. But of course the Behemah Tehora also needs food. It needs more food if there's seven of them. Secondly, the pasuk which describes Noah as doing what he was commanded, and number three, Hashem telling Noah to come to the Teva. Therefore, the two and the seven seem to bracket these other matters. And what are we to make of all of this? So I'd like to present an approach to this which I believe is quite fascinating. It's based on the Sefer Maase Hashem. The Maase Hashem, Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, one of the great early Acharonim, and his Perush on the Torah is a classic. And he brings us back to the beginning. Yesh Dorshim Lignai. Some people look a little bit askance at Noah. They give him a bit of a negative verdict. Why? In other words, even if the Pasuk is seen, you wish to say that the Pasuk is indicating that only B'derosav, but what is there negative to say about Noah? I mean, he's a tzaddik. Except, as we know, however we'll explain it, that as much as Noah was a tzaddik, but he really did seem to keep to himself. We don't find a great deal of outreach with Noah. He doesn't seem to try and interact with the surrounding to influence them for the better. He's meant to build a teva so that people take an interest. No one took an interest. I mean, it's 120 years he was building the teva. It's a long time. And indeed, it is with regards to this, some Mefarshim say, that he is compared negatively with Avram. That was in contrast to Avram, who was very much with people, helping them, influencing for the better, involved in their welfare, interested in their well-being. And Noah seems to keep to himself a little bit more. And moreover, the Maaseh Hashem explains that this is actually the meaning of that expression which is used to describe Noah, Tzadik Tomim. Tzadik Tomim. Now, those two expressions, we normally look upon them as pretty much heading in the same direction, and one, if anything, completing the other. Tzadik is a tzadik, needs no translation, and tomim is complete, meaning more than a tzadik. I guess there's incomplete tzadikim, like tzadik gomor, we would say. So not only is it a tzadik, he's a perfect tzadik. But the Maaseh Hashem explains that actually tzadik and tomim are two conflicting descriptions of Noah, or conflicting aspects of Noah, because tzadik, again, tzadik means he's a righteous person, and so he is. But tomim has something of a negative connotation. That's where the criticism is, because tomim means complete, but in this setting, it means that he was self-contained. He kept to himself. He's tomim. And therefore, one could almost say that tzaddik and tomim are a case and an anti-case for Noah. And therefore, yesh darshim lignai. Now, should we ask... So should Noah not be saved? Not at all. I mean, no one's saying that. And clearly, if anyone's going to be saved, and someone will, it will be Noah. I mean, he's head and shoulders above everybody else. But nonetheless, it is with certain reservations. And therefore, it seems that the Hashem's relationship with Noah is somewhat lukewarm, shall we say, even as he brings him into the to the Teva, as we will see. And therefore, the question is, so here's Noah, the point against him, again, this is Noah on his level, but the point against him is that he was never really involved in the welfare of others, certainly perfecting himself, which he did. And so now the question is, so now what? In other words, is that it? Is that Noah, and things should just remain that way? Says the Maaseh Hashem, not at all. Humankind, by this stage, has been condemned. However, there is yet room to develop Noah in the area of kindness. Other people are basically, no one else is going to make it into the Teva at this stage, but all of the animals are going to come into the Teva, and they are going to need taking care of. And taking care of an animal is an act of chesed. And Noah is basically placed in charge of the entire animal kingdom for a year in order to develop within him, one could almost say, it's training for when the Mabul is over and the world becomes populated again, to take an interest in the welfare of others. And therefore, it's downscaled to the animal kingdom, but it's an important year for Noah. And as we pointed out numerous times in the past, If the Tevas Noach is just, quote-unquote, an issue of saving Noach, there's plenty of other ways to save Noach. He doesn't need to be cooped up or hermetically sealed in a zoo for a whole year. I mean, that's not a pleasant situation to be in, especially as the Gemara tells us in Zvachim and Daf Kuf Yud Gimel that the Mabul did not affect Eretz Yisrael, so you could bring him to Eretz Yisrael. He could be in Herzliya for a year to... It would be very easy. However, the year of the Mabul is not just a year of salvation for Noah. It's a year of rehabilitation for him, developing in the area of chesed. And how do we see this? After Hashem tells him to bring two of each into the Teva, he then says, in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Ve'ato kach lecha, Mikol ma'achal asher yachel. Now, you need to begin to set about taking an interest in the needs of others. The entire animal kingdom is going to need food for a year. How it was stored in the Mishkan is, in the Teva is another question, but with the dimensions being what they were. But Noah's job, you need to go and assemble and collect food and organize food for all of them. And that is as much for Noah, says Maaseh Hashem, as it is for the animals. And moreover, the pasuk makes a point of telling us that Noach did this. I mean, it's not a chiddush that he did it as he was told, but in other words, it's describing something of a change within Noach. Pasuk kafes, vayas Noach, kechol asher tziva osa elokim kein osa. According to the Maaseh Hashem, that's not just about building the teva, it's specifically about what he was told to do just now. He went himself to collect food. Apparently he didn't enlist anyone else to help him, but it's only him, and this is Noach developing in the art of giving. And from that point of view, one can look upon this time for Noah as something of a transitional time, because he's beginning to help others. And there are reverberations, there are expressions of this. For example, if you take a look at the next pasuk, Vayomer Hashem leNoach. Hashem says to Noach. Is that a chiddush? Has Hashem spoken to Noach before? He has. This is the first time that the name Yudke Vavke appears in the parsha. And until now, it's been Elokim. Vayomer Elokim leNoach, Keit Kabasar, etc. Vayas Noach, Kechol Asher Tziva Oso Elokim. And as we mentioned, because it's a strictly, one could say, a business relationship at that stage, because things haven't yet warmed towards Noah, but he is the one that's going to be saved. Al pi din, if it's anyone, it's going to be him. But we don't find any warm feeling there. But things change as a result of Noah beginning to take the step to collect all the food. We find for the first time, Vayoma Hashem le Noah. And moreover, Hashem says to Noah, Boata, come, v'chobe Yisrael ateva. Ki oscha ra'isi tzaddik lefanai bedor hazeh. I've seen you as a tzaddik before me in this generation. And what's interesting is, and Rashi notes as to many others, something has been dropped from the description of Noach. In the beginning of the parsha, he was called tzaddik tomin. And now he's called tzaddik. Has he gone down in the world? No, says the Maaseh Hashem. He's gone up in the world. Because at the beginning of the parsha, tzaddik was the case for him, and tomim was a point against him. But he's come out of his tmimus because he's begun to collect food for others, and it's better for him to be called a tzaddik alone than to be called tzaddik tomim. And there is a further point. The idea of bringing a korban, which of course is a great deal to speak about, but the word korban itself has a connotation of kirva. It's about drawing close to Hashem. And because that's true, as we know, not everyone is really entitled to bring a korban. Certainly someone who's a Rasha, the pasuk says, Zevach Rasha'im To'eva, that's an abomination from a Rasha. But even in terms of experience in Chumash to date, there were two people who brought a korban, and one got a good reception, and one got a bad reception, and it was a reflection of them and the korban that they brought. Cain brought a korban, it was not received very warmly, and Hevel brought, and it was, and that's a reflection of the difference between them. And therefore, says Maaseh Hashem, and this I believe is a point of chiddush, Noah, in the fullness of time, will bring korbanos. However, when he was originally told to make the teva, he was not yet on a level that he could gather in animals for korbanos, because there was a certain distance between Hashem and him, represented by the name Elohim, because he was tamim, because he was closed off, and therefore Hashem says, I'm going to save you, but we're not yet close, and we're not yet talking about, we're not yet korbanos friendly. And therefore, at that stage, how many of each animal? Two. And the point of the Maaseh Hashem is what, even the pure ones? Yes. Two. Korbanos? Not yet. Something has to happen. Noach needs to develop until HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be prepared to receive korbanos from him. And what is that thing? The events mentioned in these intermittent psukim. He's been collecting food. He's more of a tzaddik now, less of a tamim. And then Hashem says, okay, now we can talk about something else. This karbonus to be brought, and now I'm prepared to receive karbonus from you. And therefore, the point in Parshanut between Masi Hashem and Rashi is that originally in Perek Vav Pasuk Yutes, when Hashem said, bring two of each, and Rashi says, well, you know, some is more, but it means no less than two of each. That's how Rashi explained, implying that the plan already at that stage was there would be more. However, for the Masi Hashem, in that early stage of the end of Perek Vav, when Hashem said two of each, it literally meant two of each. No more, no less, but also no more. The whole idea of more than two, namely building up to seven, was a product of the development of events as are described in the Psukim. So this is truly a wonderful Parshanut approach to the beginning of Parshas Noah. And it's always important to remind ourselves as we discuss Noah, certainly in terms of his relationship with his surroundings, etc., beginning with Noah, and perhaps even before Noah, one already can sense that there are some people who they delight and feast over the shortcomings of the figures in the Chumash. Whenever someone makes a mistake, they congratulate themselves that there's no question in their mind that if they were there, they would have gotten everything right, what everyone seems to be getting wrong. One could almost call them armchair biblical figures. But of course, that's missing the point entirely, because the moral of the story is not for us to be talking about Noah, but to be learning from him and perhaps thinking about ourselves. To what extent are we, firstly, hopefully, tzaddikim, and secondly, perhaps, tamimim, to what extent do we take an interest in our surroundings? To fault Noah and not to learn from him is only to compound the problem, and that's an important orientation always with regards to the greats of the Chumash. So these are some opening comments with regards to the beginning of the Parsha, and I'd like to move from there to post-Mabul and to talk for a few moments about the rainbow, the Bris HaKeshes, which is to be found in Perek Tes. And it actually takes place over a number of psukim. But the gist of the psukim, before we get to them, of course, is that somehow the rainbow now is the sign, and when a rainbow occurs, so on the one hand it's perhaps negative that a marble should be in the wings, but of course it won't happen because Hashem has promised that it won't happen. And there is actually a bracha to make. When one sees a rainbow, a bracha to be recited, Zocher Abris, Veneman Bibriso, Zekayam B'Mamara. We thank Hashem for remembering the bris, because without that, perhaps there would be trouble. which means, according to this, the presence of a rainbow is actually a negative sign. And indeed, we know from certain places in Chazal that there were individuals that the hallmark of their tzidkus was that no rainbow was ever seen in their time. Famous examples are Chizkiyahu HaMelech, Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, and Rabbi Shua ben Levi. As Rabbi Shua ben Levi made his famous entry into Gan Eden while he was still alive, and they wanted to establish his credentials, they asked him, Niras HaKeshes Beinecha, you're Rabbi Shua ben Levi, did they ever see a rainbow in your time? Because if the answer is yes, then maybe he's not the Rabbi Shua ben Levi that they had heard about. Even though, as is discussed by a number of Mefarshim, beginning with Ramban, the rainbow is it's a natural phenomenon as far as we know, with the moisture in the air, and then the sun will hit it and post the rain. It's natural for a rainbow to come out. So it's interesting that a natural phenomenon, which as far as we know perhaps even preceded the Mabul, because it did rain before the Mabul, and the sun shone before the Mabul, which means that presumably the rainbow existed before the Mabul, it seems that it was almost commandeered as the sign of the bris here. But in terms of the psukim here, we need to consider that they seem to be quite wordy and repetitious, repetitive. Beginning with Pasuk Yud Gimel, whereby if we just read them through once, we'll really get a sense that it seems to be saying the same thing as Kashtina Satipa Anand, the rainbows that will be in a cloud, the Haisala Os Brispe Niyovena Art, and that will be the sign of the covenant. The Hayaba Anani Anan Allah Art Vinarasa Keshis Ba Anan, when there will be a cloud, so then you can see the rainbow in the cloud. Vizakhartias Brisia Shebini of Enechem, I'll remember my bris between me and you, Uvinko Nefesh Chaya Bechol Basar, Velo Ye Od Maim Lamabul Lishachais Kol Basar, and there will be no more Mabul. And that is that. Next, Pasuk Tet Zayin, the whole thing again. V'haisa keshes ba'anan, the rainbow will be in the cloud, u'risia, I'll see it, l'skor b'risola, bein elukim, u'vein kol nefesh chaya, v'chol basar asher al ha'aretz. So this idea seems almost word for word repeated between the psukim of Yudalet Tetvav, and then once again in Tetzayin. And the one who gets involved here, and who will guide us in these psukim, is the Netziv in the HaMikdavar. And the Netziv says, as much as these psukim seem to be reiterating one for the other, if we look closely, we will see that there are actually certain differences between them, which also need to be addressed. For example, how will the rainbow appear? The verb used in the two instances is not the same. If we take a look in Pasuk Yudalet, it says, "Vayabanani ala art v'nirasa keshes ba'anan." The rainbow will nirasa, will appear. Okay. Contrast that with Pasuk Tetzayin, which says, "V'haisa keshes ba'anan." The rainbow will be in the cloud. In what way will the rainbow be in the cloud? It's only there to the extent that you could see it, which means v'haisa is the same as nirasa. For it to be there is the same as it appearing there. What then is the difference between these two terms? Another interesting point of contrast, in Pasuk Tesvav, the first iteration, shall we say, v'zacharti esbrisi asher beini uveneichem. I'll remember the bris which is between me and you. Okay, who's me? Well, it's Hashem talking. But in Pasuk Tetzayin, after v'haisa keshes ba'anan u'risia l'skor bris olam, I'll remember the bris, bein elokim uvein kol nefesh chaya b'chol basar sher la'aretz. So Hashem, although he's speaking, is referring to himself almost in the third person, so to speak. What's the difference between a bris beini and a bris bein elokim? And the final difference, and again the Netziv is beckoning us to look at these psukim thoroughly and closely, is that what will the consequence of this be? In the end of Pasuk Tetzvav, I'll remember the bris, v'inu v'nechem, and the result will be v'lo yiyeh ot hamayim l'mabul, and there will therefore no longer be a mabul, l'shacheis kol basar. That's the result of the remembrance. In Pasuk Tetzayin, it says, I'll see it, and I'll remember the bris, and that's the end of the Pasuk. It doesn't say, and then what will happen, or then what will not happen. It just concludes, Bein Elokim, Uvein Kol Nefesh Chaya, V'chol Basar, Asher Al Ha'aretz. So now that we've taken a good look at these two sets of psukim, we can begin to try and unravel them. And then the Netziv explains that the fundamental point here, we are familiar with the rainbow as the Os Bris, the sign of the covenant, which it is, that's explicit in the Torah. The key, says the Netziv, is to understand that actually the rainbow is not the Os of one Bris, but of two. There are two Brisos that are represented by the rainbow. Now here, of course, the one being spoken about at this stage is the bris that there will never again be a mabul. Says the Netziv, that's the second bris. But there is a prior bris. And should we ask, well, we've never heard of this. I mean, where is the first bris? Says Netziv, it's in the beginning of our parsha. Have a look in Perek Vav, Pasuk Kafches. Pardon me. Pardon me, where are we? Yudches. Thank you. So Hashem says, there's going to be a marble. I will uphold my covenant with you. That's interesting. That means that the bris already in reference from the very beginning of the parsha. The question is, what is that bris? And you know, again, Mefarshim are alerted to this and discuss it. What is this earlier bris? The pasuk doesn't really say. It says the Netziv, this bris is essentially the covenant between Hashem and humankind for it to continue. In other words, from the very beginning, Hashem created Adam and Chava and blessed them, and gave them the world. And therefore, the original bris is basically Hashem created the world in order for it to continue. Noah will represent the continuation of the human race, because everyone else will be destroyed. Through him, it will continue. Which means, says the Netziv, that when Hashem says, "Vakimosi es brisi itach," and in fact the pasuk doesn't say, "and I will establish," or more correctly, it doesn't say that I will cut a covenant with you. It doesn't say the korasi brisi itach, which we always say koreis habris when a covenant is made. Hashem isn't making the covenant with Noah. He's already made it with Adam and Chava. He is upholding it, itach, with you, meaning through you, through your survival, I will uphold the covenant that I've already made with humankind. Which means that there will be a mabul at that stage. But the first bris is that someone will survive. After the mabul, the second bris is there will never be a mabul again. And both of these brisos are reflected in the oath of the keshes. How so? Because the Netziv, we need to appreciate that the rainbow can appear in one of two ways. And they are referred to respectively as Nirasa HaKeshes and Haisa HaKeshes. What is the difference between those two? Well, after it rains, a rainbow can appear. That's quite common and quite normal. And in a sense, that is actually a Siman Bracha. Because that's, you know, the rain has come and the world is okay. That type of rainbow, if we start with the second type of appearance, v'haisa, that type of rainbow is called v'haisa. Because the word v'haisa, certainly through Chazal and even in the Parshanut on the level of Pshat, the word v'haisa has the connotation of being there and staying there. The haisa, to be there. Whenever the word yihiyu or hayu features the way the halacha darshans it is, the havayosan yihu, it is there and shall remain as such. And therefore, the pasuk tet zayin, the second type of appearance, which is called the haisa, means that it can often happen, commonly occur, that the rainbow will be there and stay there. That's what we would call a natural viewing of the rainbow. And what does that represent? That represents life continuing and things are well. And therefore, the pasuk says in Tet Zayin, V'haisa keshes ba'anan uri isiha, I will see it, liskor bris olam, that's a remembrance, so to speak, of the bris olam, the bris of the world, bein elokim uvein kol nefesh chaya v'chobasar shara la'aretz. The word Elohim, which has a number of connotations, but the Netziv understands throughout his papers that Elohim refers to Hashem as controlling the world, as guiding the natural world. And the first verse is really about that, about the continuation of the human race, things continuing. And therefore, the Haisa, that prolonged or viewing or apparition of the rainbow is a sign of the bris bein Elokim, just between Hashem allowing the world to continue as it should. And that's why that second pasuk does not conclude by saying, and there will never again be a mabul, because that first bris wasn't about whether there'll be a mabul or not. That first bris was about the human race continues. However, there is another way that the rainbow can appear, and that is, it's less natural in a sense, namely that it appears in a momentary way. There, you see it, next time you look around, it's not there anymore. That's a little less common. And that is referred to as nirasa, because that means that it appears, but that's it. Next time you see it, not there anymore. And that is the apparition of the appearance of the rainbow that has a negative connotation. And therefore, Hashem says in Pasuk, Yudalad Vayab Barani Anunat La'aret, Venirasa Keshes Ba'anan. If it's Venirasa, that's already a sign that the Mabul almost should be coming. But Pasuk Desvav, Vizachart, Yes, Grisya, Shebeni, Uvein Echem, that I'm making right now between me and you, Uvein Konefish Chayab, Bechobasa, Velo Ye'od Hamayim LaMabul, and there won't be a Mabul anymore. So the momentary appearance of the rainbow is the sign with regards to the bris that there will no longer be a Mabul, which has a subtext that maybe there should be. That's why it's a negative sign. And therefore, says the Netziv, aside from understanding the psukim now, where the whole thing has opened up, this section of psukim, we also understand that not every time a rainbow appears, is it a bad thing? Is it a negative sign? We take all appearances together, but rather it depends. If you see the rainbow, and a moment later you see it again, it's a good sign. If you don't see it again, so then it's one of those. And in fact, says the Netziv, we see how the nuance and the phraseology of the pasuk then translated into the Gemara. We go back to that episode where Rabbi Shua ben Levi, he was confronted there in Gan Eden. They wanted to know, is he really Rabbi Shua ben Levi? They asked him, Nirasa keshes be'enecha? Did a rainbow appear in your time? They never asked, was there ever a rainbow in your time? Because according to the Netziv, there can be, and that's okay. As long as it stays there, it's good. Haisa keshes is good. Nirasa keshes is not so good. And that's why they were medactic in as they raised the question, was it Nirasa Keshes B'Yamecha? So these are the comments of the Netziv, again, to see how the greats learn the Chumash and explain the Psukim, paying attention to the phraseology, something seems repeated, certain discrepancies, guided by the right hand, the whole parsha opens up. I'd like to conclude by talking about someone who I believe we've never really spoken about. He comes in at the end of the parsha, and he is Nimrod. Now, we know a thing or two about Nimrod, and let's see the psukim, and let's see what Rashi has to say. Perek Yud Pasuk Ches. So we're in the 70 nations, the 70 families, and the Kush Yoladis Nimrod. So Kush actually has other children. In Pasuk Zayin, Uvnei Kush, there's Seva v'Chavila v'Savta v'Rama v'Savtacha. So there, but then Nimrod gets his own pasuk. He's almost like Kush starts again. And as the Malbim explains, because Nimrod isn't one of the 70 nations, he's just a very significant individual, so he gets his own pasuk, but he's not together with the others, because there's no nation called Nimrod, which I think is a good thing. But pasuk ches, b'kush yilad is Nimrod, hu hechel liyos gibor ba'aretz. He began to be a mighty man in the world. What does that mean? We don't know yet. Pasuk tes, hu haya gibor tzayed lifnei Hashem. He was a mighty hunter before Hashem, Akein Yamar, and so it will be said that there is a certain type of individual, they'll say about him, he's like Nimrod. Ki Nimrod Gibor Tzayed Lifnei Hashem. So he almost like he developed an iconic status, whereby some people say, oh, that's a Nimrod person. Now, who is Nimrod, and what do these phrases mean? Well, Rashi explains, and Rashi is based on the Medrash, and he takes them one by one, and each one is worse than the other. He's a gibor, says Rashi, Leos gibor. What does that mean? He's mighty in what way? Lahamrid kol ha'olam al HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'atzas dor ha'plaga. He's the one. He's gibor. He's mighty in the sense that he's getting everyone organized to rebel against Hashem. He's the force behind the dor ha'plaga. Interestingly, the pasuk doesn't identify any one individual as an organizer in the dor ha'plaga. We seem to think that they were already organized. Next, gibor tzayit. He's a mighty hunter. He's a trapper, says Rashi. Sadatam shabrios. He entices people. He chaps them. The fib. He's able to persuade them. Umata'an nimrod bamakam. And he's able to mislead them to rebel against Hashem. So gibor tzayid, not good. Lefnei Hashem. And all of this is before Hashem. Misgavin lahaknito aponav. He's aware of Hashem's existence, presence. He's looking to anger him. Lahachis, what's called. And therefore, says Rashi, anyone who's like that, they say he's like Nimrod. So I think we could sum up Rashi's comments by saying that Rashi is Mefarish Lignai. That Nimrod, all these things, they're somewhat vague in the Pasuk. Rashi pins them down. He's a Gibor in a negative sense. Gibor Tzayit, even worse. Lefnei Hashem, worse than that. Interestingly, the Ibn Ezra has a certain comment on Nimrod, and as we will see, quite different than Rashi. Nimrod says, Ibn Ezra says that when the Pasuk describes Nimrod as Gibor Tzayid Lifnei Hashem, he was a mighty hunter before Hashem, says Ibn Ezra, it means he was a very successful hunter. And what did he do with the animals that he trapped and caught? Lifnei Hashem, he brought them before Hashem. He brought them as korbanos. Now that's a scandalous thing. If we've never heard it before, we've grown up with Rashi, and all of a sudden Ibn Ezra is saying, Gibor Tzayid Lifnei Hashem, everything that Rashi was Dorish Lignai, Ibn Ezra seemingly is Dorish Lishvach. And these two opinions of Rashi and the Ibn Ezra, two approaches to Nimrod, are both quoted by Ramban. He starts with Rashi and then quotes Ibn Ezra. And then Ramban lets us know whom he sides with. Says Ramban, the Ein Devar of Nirim. I don't think that Ibn Ezra's words are correct. Vehinei humastik Russia. He's portraying a Russia as a tzaddik. This is most objectionable. Ki Rabuseinu Yod Rusha Kabbalah, Chazal knows through tradition about his evil ways. This explanation of Ibn Ezra is unacceptable, says Ramban. Now, this objection of Ramban to Ibn Ezra's Peirush needs to be examined for the simple reason that we know when it comes to the area of Parshanut, when it comes to the area of explaining and understanding Psukim, not all Peirushim will be the same. And moreover, it is found, can be, that later Mefarshim will explain the Pasuk quite differently than earlier Mefarshim. And also that entails that Mefarshim, shall we say, post-Chazal, will explain or can explain the Psukim in a way that differs from the way that Chazal explained them. The one who formulated this is the Orachayim HaKadosh, Rabbi Chaim ben Atar, already in Parshas Bereishis, and he says, you should know, as long as the halacha is not affected, and you need to know whether the halacha will be impacted by this, but if it's purely a question of understanding the psukim, rishus nitna, for a person who has delved into the psukim, that means he understands, and he's invested the requisite time and study and immersion. He's attained his qualifications. It's not a person who's opened the Chumash and said the first thing that comes into his head, which some people, many articles are based on reactions like that. But someone who has done due diligence, says the Ibn Ezra, says the Orachayim HaKadosh, so Shivim Panim LaTorah. And he, in fact, demonstrates this from the Gemara. We know that rabbis of the Gemara, Amoraim, can never argue with a rabbi of the Mishnah, a Tana. If you have a Tana against you and no other Tana for support, you're out. That's in halacha, says the Rahayim HaKadosh. However, you'll note, quite common in the Shas, that when the Gemara wants to know, but what is the source of a halacha, and it brings a number of sources, and assuming there's no halachic difference between the sources, you'll find that Tanaim will provide their sources, and Amoraim will then come along and give other sources. Whatever happened to the idea that an Amora can't argue with a Tana, says the Orachaim, that's in halacha. This is Parshanut. It's a very well-known Orachaim, but again, it has to be treated responsibly. But it's formulated by the Orachaim, but it's not a chiddush of the Orachaim. I mean, this is true from always. And in fact, some Rishonim, shall we say, are well-known for their explanations of Pesukim that are not like Chazal. It doesn't mean they're the only ones that did it. Ibn Ezra, shall we say, at the risk of oversimplifying, is known for doing this. He's not the only one that does it. The Ramban does it. And so does Rashi. Each one, as one goes through their Perush, Rashi will say, this is what the Medrash says, this is what Chazal say. However, in my opinion, Lefi Pshuto, it's Kach V'Kach. Ramban will say, Darshi Rabbi Seinu, Om Rabbi Seinu, and then the Hanachon, the Einai, Kach V'Kach. So both Rashi, who is, of course, generally very faithful in bringing the words of Chazal, but he will give his own opinion on occasion, and the Ramban here, who objected to the Ibn Ezra's approach, because what do you mean? Chazal said he's a Rasha. What are you saying he's a Tzaddik for? Well, but Ibn Ezra does this, and so does the Ramban. So what really is the measure of his objection with the Ibn Ezra? The answer is, it lies in the concluding words of Ramban. Ramban says, Ein Devar Avnirim, I don't think his approach is correct, Behinehu Maftik Rasha, he's portraying a Rasha to be a Tzaddik, V'kvar Kiblu Chazal Rishoso, Chazal are received a tradition with regards to him being a Rasha. In other words, what Ramban is saying is there is an important distinction to be made when it comes to the comments that we have from Chazal between Peirush Chazal and Kabbalas Chazal. Peirush Chazal means that Chazal looked at the Pasuk, and of course one can't do better than Chazal, but nonetheless, they gave their Peirush. Shivim Panim LaTorah means there's room for another Peirush. However, when it comes to Kabbalas Chazal, if they have a Kabbalah from however far it goes back, and interestingly, by the way, Kabbalas with regards to this sort of thing, we would say, does it go back even to Sinai? Some of these Kabbalas can go back even prior to Sinai, because Nimrod lived before Sinai. Which means that if you know through the Ovis, etc., there's certain things that we know about life before Sinai that are Kabbalas in the nation dating back prior to Sinai. And therefore, says Ramban, I perceive Chazal's approach to Nimrod as based on the Kabbalah that they had. At that point, there's nothing else to discuss. Any contrary approach is a waste of time. It's not a Peirush that Chazal gave. They're transmitting. They're not interpreting. And that's why he finds Ibn Ezra so objectionable here. Now, let us ask, well, what about Ibn Ezra? I mean, he did say it. And what does he think of all of this? I mean, Peirush Chazal, Kabbalah's Chazal, does he feel that there, he could even say something contrary to Kabbalah's Chazal? Let's see. The answer will come from the Ibn Ezra's own words, relating to a pasuk at the end of the parsha, when the very end, the final psukim, Perek Yud Aleph, where Avram and Nahor marry. And that is in Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Kaftes. Maftir. Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Kaftes. Vayikach Avram v'Nachor lahem nashim. Avram and Nachor both took wives. Shame Eishes Avram Sarai. Avram's wife was Sarai. V'shem Eishes Nachor Milcah. Nachor's wife is Milcah, who is Bas Haran, the daughter of Haran, who is Avi Milcah v'Avi Yiscah, the father of Milcah and of Yiscah. Now, who is Yiscah? Well, if you look at Rashi, you will see that Yiscah is Sarah. It's another name for Sarah. Why is she called Yiscah? Rashi gives three perushim. But the bottom line is Yiscah is Sarah. Now, the Ibn Ezra quotes this Rashi's from the Medrash, and this is not Rashi's own Peirush, it's from the Medrash. Yitzchak is none other than Sar. Says Ibn Ezra, Amru Kadmoneinu, at the earlier, right, Chazal said that Yitzchak is Sarah. And then, says Ibn Ezra, V'im Kabbalahi, if it's that's a Kabbalah, a tradition, Nikabel, we'll accept it. Now, those are rather enigmatic words of the Ibn Ezra, because when he says, if it's a Kabbalah, we'll accept it, really what he's saying is, if were it not to be a Kabbalah, I would not have said that. And moreover, I have grounds to say that perhaps it's not the case. Why? Because if you look at the Pasuk, as Mefarshe Ibn Ezra explained, if you look at the Pasuk, it seems on a straightforward level, it doesn't seem that Yitzchak is Sarah. Why not? Because the Pasuk says that Avram and Nachor both married. Avram's wife is Sarah. Nachor's wife is Milcah. And Milcah is the daughter of Haran, who is the father of Milcah and Yitzchak. If Yitzchak is Sarah, then Milcah is not the only one who's a daughter of Haran in the Pasuk. So is Sarah. She's the Yitzchak that will be mentioned at the end. Which means the Pasuk would better have said that Avram's wife is Sarai, Shem Esh is Nachor Milcah, Benos Haran, Avima. For whatever reason you want to say that you want to call Sarah Yitzchak, for whatever reason, but it doesn't change the fact that both Sarah and Milcah are daughters of Haran. But the Pasuk says, Bas Haran. The implication is that only Milcah was a daughter of Haran, and Sarah wasn't, because Haran is the father of Yitzchak, but not of Sarah. That all of this really is the between the lines. What the Ibn Ezra is indicating when he says, if it's a Kabbalah, we'll accept it. Because what he's saying is, we're not a Kabbalah, we're not saying the Pasuk that way. But you do see, therefore, that the Ibn Ezra, something that he identifies as Kabbalah's Chazal, so then although he has something that he would prefer to say, it doesn't matter anymore, and he retracts, or he doesn't say it. And what that means is that the Ibn Ezra, in principle, is completely in line, or sees eye to eye, with Rambam, in principle. In other words, they both agree to subscribe to the distinction between Kabbalah's Chazal and Peirush Chazal. If it's a Peirush of Chazal, both Ibn Ezra and Rambam will feel that they are entitled, if they understood the Pasuk differently, to explain differently. If it's Kabbalah's Chazal, then neither of them will say anything. And here, Nimrod is kind of in the middle. Ibn Ezra explained not like Chazal. Ramban charges him with violating Kabbalah's Chazal. What will Ibn Ezra say? So presumably, the Ibn Ezra will say, I'm not sure that when they said that Nimrod was a Rasha, that was the product of the Kabbalah. And really, that raises it itself an interesting question. As much as you have this very, very important distinction between Kabbalah and Peirush, how can you know what's a Kabbalah and what's a Peirush? Maybe sometimes it's clear, sometimes it's not so clear, and sometimes it's a machlokus, and that part of the machlokus between them is, is this a Kabbalah that I can't dispute, or explain differently then, or is it a Peirush that I can? And here, for Ramban, that's really now the question, how does Ramban know that it's a Kabbalah that is the basis of Chazal's words? And on what basis does the Ibn Ezra argue? So it seems not so much, but it's important to formulate it as such. The Machlokas Ramban and Ibn Ezra here is not a question of principle, but a question of where to draw the lines. Exactly what falls on which side. But there is a postscript, and that is added by Rav Kupperman, that's all. And that is, let's go back to Gibor Ba'aretz, which is Perek Tes, Pasuk, Perek Yud, Pasuk Tes. Nimrod, who echelius Gibor Ba'aretz? He was a Gibor Ba'aretz. What does Gibor Ba'aretz mean? Well, we've seen Rashi. Ramban has a Peirush. And Ramban says, it appears to me that Gibor Ba'aretz means, I mean, what, he was the first mighty man? What does that mean? How do you quantify that? What it means, says Ramban, in my understanding, is that Nimrod was actually the first person to really take control of others. which is an interesting shine, actually, because people, they started with a small number, then there's a bigger number. At what point does someone see to it that they become the leader of their group and perhaps even impose themselves on other groups? That's Nimrod. He was the first one. I mean, nowadays, everyone does that. But Nimrod was the first. And as surely, you know, as the Torah tells us, in certain cases, who was the first person to do what? Yaval and Yuval, etc., and Parshas Bereishis. So to here, if you're ever wondering, who was the first one that invaded another kingdom to expand, another group to expand their kingdom? Now you know, it's Nimrod. And that's why Pasuk Yud says, Vati Reishis Mamlachto, he's the first person referred to as a king. He's the first one who had a kingdom. And moreover, it began in Babel, but it spread. So it wasn't a kingdom, it was an empire. He had an imperial bent. I think that says Ramban, I think that's what it means. Hu haya gibor ba'aretz. He was the first mighty man in that way to assert himself over his group and then over other groups. Okay. There's just one problem. Chazal have already explained this pasuk, hu haya gibor ba'aretz, as brought to us by Rashi, that it means he was gibor ba'aretz to build Migdal Babel to rebel against Hashem. That's what it's talking about. And the reason why the question is so accentuated is because it's over this very point that the Ramban got so upset with Ibn Ezra, as if to say, how can you just give your own interpretation, right? We've got a Kabbalah about this, right? You say he built Mizbechos, Lifnei Hashem, he brought his animals as korbanos. How can you say that? Chazal said differently. They have a Kabbalah about this. And then Chazal says, Gibor Ba'aretz means he built Migdal Babel, and Ramban says, but I think it means that he was the first one to build an empire. How did the issue that you had Ibn Ezra not rebound upon you yourself, Ramban? And Rav Kuperman explains that what we need to do is to distinguish between, when we talk about traditions of Chazal, Kabbalah, things that we know from Chazal, there are Kabbalahs with regards to things, people and events, and there are Kabbalahs with regards to explanations of psukim. In other words, when we say that Chazal had a Kabbalah about Nimrod, their Kabbalah is about Nimrod, or their Kabbalah is about how to explain the psukim that talk about Nimrod. The Ramban clearly understands, as much as he's very emphatic, that Chazal have a Kabbalah about Nimrod, but that's a tradition about Nimrod, the person. Namely, he was a Rasha. What about the psukim? There's no Kabbalah about that. What do they mean? Whatever they look like they mean. You have to study them and see. Chazal gave their peirushim, and Ramban can give another peirush. His objection is with the Ibn Ezra, because the peirush Ibn Ezra gave to the psukim is contrary to the tradition about Nimrod the person. If Chazal say that he was a rasha, you can't explain the pasuk to say that he's going around bringing korbanos before Hashem. That's off limits. But any peirush of the pasuk which doesn't compromise what Chazal said received about Nimrod as a Rasha, that doesn't mean every single pasuk is talking about him being a Rasha. It just can't talk about him being a Tzaddik. And therefore, it's a very delicate balance that we have. On the one hand, Ramban is so takes such strong exception to Ibn Ezra for his Peirush that is contrary to the Kabbalah of Chazal about Nimrod. But he himself feels that he's faithful to that Kabbalah about Nimrod, even if he doesn't explain each and every part of the pasuk to be about what a Rasha Nimrod was. That's the approach of the Ramban here. So these are very important parshanut considerations, and really from Noah all the way till Bereishis, all the way till Vezos HaBracha, that was the analysis and presentation of Rav Kuperman Zatzal. We'll leave it over there for this evening.
Gentlemen, we have a minion and it's so close.